Okay, so this is just what we derived last time. I was just writing it out again because we'll need to use it. So what I want to do is now to sort of use this. This is like a sort of basic building block, a sort of piece of Lego, if you like. And I want to start building more complicated space-time simply by stacking together this sort of basic block. It's like part of a block of a metric. So, suppose I take this, what I've written here, I'll just change R to row. So I'm going to add another bit. So here, both A and C at the moment are still just functions of one variable. I want to sort of keep this relatively straightforward for writing on a board. So I've put together essentially two of these blocks. So I'm going to imagine that this part has dimension P, and this part has dimension N. And so without doing too much work, I want to just simply more or less straight away write down what the spin connection and the curvature is. So does anyone want to hazard a guess what happens for this space-time?
Anything but with C and the other metric.
Sorry,
the R alpha beta will be just the same.
Mm-hmm.
But with A C instead of A and alpha beta instead of mu nu.
And what, sorry, the
alpha beta instead of mu nu, so the metric will be a gamma.
Right, but is there anything else you think might happen? Yeah, so that's a good starting guess. So we're kind of expecting something like that, and that's almost completely right. So I think it's reasonably obvious that at the spin connection part side, that these two pieces just don't talk to each other, right? Because in terms of getting, if we take an exterior derivative of some orthonormal basis over here, it doesn't know about the mu's don't know about the alphas. So we can see, I think it's reasonably clear anyway, that for the spin connection, we simply add now I'm going to use I and J for the orthonormal indices. So from the perspective of the spin connection, there's no cross communication. All we do is we've got the original connection one forms, and we simply get some extra ones for the extra space that we've added. So then if we look now at what happens to the curvature, so if we go back to how we derived, so we don't want to jump straight to Ricci. If we go back to how we derived the curvature two forms, then we can sort of see that the AB2 forms are going to be the same. And also the IJ2 forms, we can simply write those by analogy. One other thing that we get, because we now have here a theta I rho, and we've also got a theta A rho. So there is a cross term other through the theta wedge theta
question.
Part of the curvature, yeah?
And your R I rho, shouldn't the omega rho, the rho index be new?
If you want to pull it down, you'd have to put a minus sign.
Mm-hmm. But
so
you have I rho in this subject, so.
Yeah, in this case, though, these are just labels,
yeah.
Okay? So that this is not really an abstract index type of thing. This is an object labeled by I and rho. And on this side, I lower the index, but if you wanted to put the rho down, you'd have to lower it with eta
yeah,
rho rho, so this would be minus C double primed on C, omega rho, if you want. It's, you know, it's kind of, in a sense, it's not, you know, if you want to keep accounts, then yes, do that by all means. But it's simply that, you know, this object is a sort of element of the covector basis. This is just labeling a scalar. It's not telling you sort of, you know, it's not the abstract.
But if you put the index down, then you can read rotate the Riemann with two ups and two downs, right? The Riemann that you will read is with two ups and two downs, because you read the Riemann component, the first up and the second down from the indices in the left, and then the second from the fourth, the indices of the Riemann.
Yeah.
You will have one up, one down, one up, one down.
If you took the latter thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, this is the definition of the curvature two form here. So that's why that's why I have a tendency, in as much as is possible, to keep those labels upstairs. So yes, it does look strange because we get sort of so conditioned into keeping our indices balanced. But that's again because normally we're using this abstract index notation where the index really means a covariant or contravariant object. So that was a fair point. So apart from our notes from the last lecture, I'm simply going to rewrite down the Riemann components that we had from the curvature two forms for the AB, and then by analogy, the IJs, and then we'll add in the extra piece. So yesterday, we derived our coordinate basis Riemanns. This was the Riemann line completely in the G mu nu box, and using that expression I can simply translate to the Riemann line completely in my gamma subspace. Then we have the Riemann components that have either mu indices and a rho index, or alpha indices and a rho index. And then we've also got this new term, notice at this point I am being careful to put my indices straight, okay? So now pulling this together, we see that the Ricci tensor was essentially more or less what we expected. Our initial guess. But there's another term to it, which is because the two sort of building blocks have this sort of cross-talking. And finally, or have I put the sign wrong there? I've done it with one up and one down. So you can see a pattern emerging here. I could add another block of space, and I would get the same, I would sort of add a similar extra Ricci term with the same sort of shape, but then I would have to add in these cross terms for the new building block that I'd added. So I would simply add in, say if it was dimension D, I'd have to add in D, B prime on B, A primed on A, or whatever, in the R mu nu piece. So you can sort of build up now spacetimes that have these sort of box symmetries. So this can be useful if you're trying to look for solutions. For example, what I've written down there in terms of just two units, this example here, gives you something which has, I've chosen to put the time in here, but this segment has P minus one spatial dimensions. So you've got something which is sort of it's like a world volume of dimension P. There's an orthogonal direction rho, but then there's some transverse subspace, which if you made it, say, spherical, two sphere, three sphere, n sphere, might represent some sort of brain-like object. You have a space that's surrounding it. If this was a two-sphere, you'd have some two-sphere surrounding your p-dimensional world volume, and you'd have some transverse direction. So this would build up a p-1 brain. So the idea is that you have some, this would be your G mu nu. Should have put it P plus one dimension, shouldn't I? Which is P dimensional. You've got some radial direction rho, but then you can think of the rho and the gamma as providing a transverse space. So say if it was an S2, this would be your gamma alpha beta. And if you think about a black hole, what is a black hole but a point-like object with a radial direction surrounded by a two-sphere, or if you're in higher dimensions, three spheres, four sphere, and so on. So this builds up sort of a black brain-like object, but it's a very particular black brain. But because all the mu nu indices have the same factor A of R. Okay? Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by brain?
Right. So by brain here, the phrase brain has become shorthand for an extended object. So here, brain means sort of extended object. So it comes from the fact that in four dimensions, you've got a point, a string, and then you have a wall or a membrane. These are 0, 1, and 2 dimensional objects from our perspective in space. These are the number of spatial dimensions. However, once you go to more than four dimensions, you could have something which had, for example, three spatial directions. And so this is saying, taking this phrase membrane and making it of arbitrary dimensionality, and it becomes a p-brain or d-brain if it has certain properties. So brain is just the sort of, has become a shorthand for something which is extended in space.
I don't quite understand. What is this minus sign?
What, sorry?
What is this minus sign in front of the
y subspace. What's the effect on physics? Because in the Riemann and the Ricci, I don't see any difference between the S subspace and the Y subspace. They look very symmetric.
Yeah, that's right, because we don't, because
but
as
then
far
if I change this minus sign into a positive sign, or correspondingly solve this minus sign into the gamma, then that's Ricci for the Y subspace.
Oh, you think I've written that down there, and then when I've gone through the calculation, I've forgotten.
Oh.
It's can I check that offline, because it's hell trying to do a minus sign in real time.
Okay.
I'll
but
tell you it's possible. So just let me check that minus sign, because it's one of, you know, it's one of the things that's absolutely the easiest thing to slip up on.
You could actually check it immediately.
Yeah, come on. So
if x and y were the same, if you split x into x and y, then if a and c are the same thing. So
actually, stop. We're not going to do this now. We'll do it at the end. Seriously, this is the worst thing to try and do in real time. No, stop. Really, it's fine if you're sitting at a desk doing a calculation, but sometimes know when you are beaten, I think. I do need to check that. I think it's all right, but I do need to check it. And I know that it's just, this is not the right scenario to do it in. So we'll just come, I'll do it really quickly at the end, but not right now. So, yep.
I have another question about the brains. Why would this metric give us a P minus one brain?
Because the time direction is in there. I should have put P plus one, okay?
Time direction is in where?
In here.
Okay.
So this has this metric here, I'm thinking, has signature plus minus minus. So I mean, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, right? So this thing has one time direction, and the dimensionality of the brain is the number of spatial dimensions. So let's go back to something familiar. And then we'll probably get you either in tutorials or homeworks to go back, come back to this calculation and start looking at some higher dimensional solutions. So here, in four dimensions, if I've got an SO3 symmetry, I can choose coordinates, angular coordinates, to give myself the canonical metric on the two-sphere. And so if I use here my building blocks with P equals 1, N equals 2, then I simply go through and pick off what I need. So the only thing I need to just note here is the fact that the two-sphere, it's a constant curvature space. So R alpha beta is minus gamma alpha beta in this case. And I'm almost sure your comment about the minus sign and that is correct, actually, but we'll see at the end. So all I have to do is put P equals 1, N equals 2, and the fact that this is a constant curvature two-sphere. So I've simply read off what the Ricci components are from that top board. So mu and nu now are only just have one value, which is t. And so I've lifted the index up. And so that just gives me, there's no p minus 1 is 0, so there's no a prime squared terms. And for the alpha beta, you see this minus 1 over c squared there comes from the fact that this is a two-sphere. So this is, you could solve this, and this would give the Schwarzschild solution, but it is in a bit of an unfamiliar gauge, right? This is not how it's most useful, it's not the most helpful gauge. So to get our familiar Schwarzschild solution, what I'd like to do is just change coordinates. And so what I'm going to do is simply rescale my radial coordinate, and then I'm going to choose the area gauge. So there are different gauge choices you can take when you're looking for solutions. And the most common one is to choose the area of two spheres to be 4 pi r squared. But that is only a choice. And in some cases, it also means that you have to be sure that as you go out in your radial direction, that the spheres are always increasing in size. Otherwise, you get a coordinate singularity. So that's a choice. You can't always do that. Sometimes the energy momentum tensor you've got doesn't allow you to do that because the area of two spheres sometimes actually gets bigger as you move in. So I'm just pointing that out because I think the first time you go through looking at solutions, you just write down r squared like it was the only thing you could do, okay? But that's not true. So now if I do this, then I get a more familiar set of equations, which we'll just very rapidly solve. So what I've decided to do here is to look, rather than just looking at vacuum solutions, I'm going to talk about black holes in a slightly more general context. I want to think about black holes when you have a cosmological constant, just so we can take our Schwarzschild solution and sort of see just how it behaves when you have just a slightly different background. So in this case, what I want to solve are the Einstein equations with a cosmological constant. So the reason the minus lambda is here is because, of course, these are Ricci components and not the Einstein tensor. So in four dimensions, that swaps the sign for you.
Any more questions? For going to this new gate, what changes did you have to do in the rigid change?
So what I've done there is, this was why I wrote this down. So if d rho is b dr, then every time you're taking a derivative, so here, this prime is now d by dr. So when you take over, for example, if we look at the first piece in here in RTT, a double primed on a, that still gives you another dA by d squared a by dr squared. That's why there's all these minus, yeah. So, Okay, so if I look at the first two equations, then let's label them 1, 2, and 3, then I can see that these first two are the same apart from this third term here. And so if I just subtract the two, then I find that A primed on A plus B primed on B is zero. So I'm going to take B equal to 1 over A. So then if I now look at the third equation, my third equation is actually, I can just now integrate straight up because it's just a first order equation in A squared. So that final equation is
a question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had a choice of taking a constant over A.
Yes, I did.
So
and the
how can you fix it?
You fix it because if I go back, well, I didn't actually write it down, did I? So if I go back here and then I go at large R, I've chosen my R to be the area coordinate. So this thing's looking like R squared, you know, d omega squared, right? Then if B and A, I mean, I'm sort of slightly skipping ahead here, but we're going to see that A, the solution is simply that A tends to a constant at infinity. So if I didn't put them quite equal, I could simply rescale my time to make them equal. A constant can, you know, is still, I've still got gauge transformations, but only constant ones, just rescalings. So I can rescale my time to set the two the same. And ultimately, I want, well, you know, I want to have my space asymptotically flat. So this kind of all ends up making that A and B tend to 1, and A equals 1 over B. So I, as you've seen before, by integrating up that equation, I get essentially like a Schwarzschild solution. So we know that C equals 2gm from the Schwarzschild solution. So let's just have a little look at what we've got here. If I set lambda equal to 0, that is Schwarzschild. It's exactly what you've seen before. If I set C equals 0, then I've simply got de Sitter space in static coordinates.
So you're assuming a sign on that, on the cosmology of a constant?
For this, yeah. I mean, I'm going to talk about anti-de-Sitter in the moment. Yeah. So if I put an A in there. So for lambda bigger than zero, let me talk, because there are different cases. For lambda bigger than zero, I've got a horizon when R is 3, square root of 3 on lambda. So in this case, if I have pure de Sitter space, I have a horizon, in other words, GTT goes to zero when R goes to L. And so this is nothing more or less than a cosmological event horizon. So you either already have or you will be seeing de Sitter space in the cosmology course. And because your space-time is like an accelerating universe, the further apart two observers are, the faster they're accelerating apart. So again, you have this idea in cosmology that your whole universe is expanding, and that's what produces cosmological redshift. Well, in this case, the universe has a sort of very constant acceleration, which is why we can write the universe in a way that looks static, these static coordinates. But the price that we have is that we get a horizon. So what this is saying is that at a certain distance away, the space is being pulled apart so fast that only an observer traveling at the speed of light would still be able to see. So this is the cosmological or acceleration horizon. So now let's think about what happens if lambda is negative. So this is anti-de Sitter space. So anti-de Sitter space is a slightly odd space-time. It's instead of, so de Sitter space is like a Lorentzian analog of a sphere. It's like a positive curvature space, but in an indefinite metric. Whereas anti-de Sitter space is negatively curved. And so it's hyperbolic. And so that makes it kind of bizarre, you know, from our intuitive point of view. It takes a while to build up intuition in anti-de Sitter space. So for de Sitter space, I translated my cosmological constant into a length scale. Here I'm translating it more into a sort of wave number. But it's the same sort of basic idea. I just wanted to distinguish between the two. So here, a squared is 1 plus k squared r squared minus c over r in general. So we still got, if c is not 0, we have an event horizon. But if c is 0, we don't have any horizon at all. So this already is quite different from de Sitter space. And in fact, if we look at it, we kind of sort of wonder, well, if I think about this one, even if I take it away, I've still got a well-behaved space-time. So that one, if we track it back, it came from the final equation there, from writing down the Einstein equations. And so that came from r theta theta. when it came from this 1 over c squared piece. The 1 over c squared piece came from the curvature of the 2 sphere. So I could imagine in this anti de Sitter case, trying to go back and think about, well, what else can I do? Can I do something a little different? So what happens if gamma alpha beta is flat or hyperbolic? So in other words, I'm going that the curvature of the two space defined by gamma would be either zero if it was flat, or it would be minus one. So kappa is minus one if that's hyperbolic. So this is exactly like in cosmology, you take a parameter which tells you about the spatial curvature of the universe. This is exactly analogous to that. We're taking a parameter kappa telling us about the curvature of this transverse space defined by gamma alpha beta. So in this case, that replaces one over c squared by kappa over c squared. And so what we get is our potential for anti de Sitter black holes is now kappa plus k squared r squared minus c on r. So even if kappa is minus one, this still gives us a well-defined Lorentzian metric. And so what this is saying is that anti de Sitter black holes, if you the sort of punchline of this, if you like, is anti de Sitter black holes can not only be spherical, but can also be planar and even hyperbolic. So that means your event horizon is no longer a two-sphere. It could be planar, and it can also actually be the H2 manifold, a completely hyperbolic two manifold. So anti de Sitter black holes have a lot more, you know, there's a lot more freedom there, yep.
Could you explain why kappa equals minus one still gives a well-defined metric?
Okay, because let's have a look at what happens here. The thing that could go wrong, if we imagine that we were in vacuum Einstein gravity, so there was no cosmological constant, you wouldn't have that piece, right? So now your potential would be minus 1 minus c on r, which would be completely negative. So in other words, dr, r would no longer be a space-like coordinate. So that would be not a Lorentzian space-time, or at least it would not be, it certainly wouldn't be a non-singular space-time. The thing about black holes is, although they do have a singularity at r equals 0, that's hidden by the event horizon. So we outside the black hole do have a sort of, our physics outside the black hole is well determined. I mean, you know, we may lose stuff to the black hole, but at least within classical physics, you know, we still have a complete evolution to the future. Whereas here, if you start tinkering around, R now would become more like a time-like coordinate, and everything would kind of get a bit of a mess. So that's basically. And obviously, if you're in Dersiter space, this now becomes negative. The problem's even worse. Whereas anti-Dersiter space, the presence of the cosmological constant kind of protects you. This as you go out in large R, this radial coordinate is always a space-like coordinate. So the final thing that I want to do with black holes is I want to do something which is just sort of taking a bit of a step back, and if you haven't seen it before, may look a bit odd. But now I just want to look at the manifold itself. And I want to imagine just taking those space-time functions, but instead of thinking of this as a space-time, I want to look at it just as a sort of a standard Euclidean manifold. So in other words, everything has a plus sign. So you could formally think of this as an analytic continuation of the Lorentzian metric. So this is a manifold which is Ricci flat. It's a Euclidean manifold which is Ricci flat. And as R goes to 2gm, I'm going to ask that it be non-singular. So why am I asking that? I'm asking it because the Lorentzian black hole metric is non-singular at 2gm. So I'm taking my black hole metric, I'm analytically continuing, and I'm just going to explore what happens. This is perfectly sensible for geometry, but I want it to be non-singular at 2gm. So that it can mirror the properties of the standard Schwarzschild black hole. So let's have a look at what happens as we go to 2gm. So at 2gm, I've got some constant size 2-sphere sitting over something in our tau space where g tau tau is going to 0. And we've now got dr squared over r minus 2gm. Now, this, if you sort of take the square root, this is just dr over the square root of r minus 2gm. And that's sort of looking like d of the square root of r minus 2gm. So let's just explore this by changing coordinates. and I'm going to take a coordinate which is proportional to the square root of 2gm. Because what I'd like to do is, what I'm aiming to do here is to get this piece looking like d rho squared, and then to have a look at what happens at the tau component. So then, if I do this and ask what d rho squared is, well, that's going to be lambda squared dr squared over 4 rho squared. And so if I choose my lambda to be 8gm, then this d rho squared will be the same as the radial part of the metric. I suppose I should put a twiddly equal. Then if I look at the T part of the metric, so what I've done here is I've chosen a new radial coordinate which is proportional to the square root of r minus 2gm. So it's like a local radial coordinate near 2gm. And there I've written something. If I define psi to be tau on 4gm, then the local metric in the tau r plane looks like d rho squared plus rho squared d psi squared, which is just polar coordinates. It's just plain polar coordinates. So as long as psi is periodic with period 2 pi, this is non-singular. Could have a conical singularity, but I don't want to, because I'm sort of going to import this idea of this has come from a Lorentzian solution. I could think of it as just a sort of completely independent Euclidean manifold, in which case, if you didn't have a periodicity of 2 pi, you would have a conical singularity. But what I'd like to do is to then say, right, I've got this arbitrary Euclidean manifold, but now I want to actually say that it has some physical relevance to the Lorentzian manifold. If it's going to have physical relevance to the Lorentzian manifold, it had better be non-singular there. So so if I make my psi angle periodic, then this is non-singular. So, i.e., my tau is identified with tau plus 8 pi gm. So, if I think about my black hole metric as actually having some being an, if analytically continued into this Euclidean metric, then I find I have a periodic Euclidean time. So why is this, what relevance does this have? Well, in quantum field theory, if you do quantum field theory at finite temperature, what you find is, to do quantum field theory at finite temperature, it corresponds to periodic Euclidean time. And so what this is telling us, or hinting to us, is that the black hole has a temperature which is in these units 1 over 8 pi gm. So this is a cheat's way of getting Hawking radiation or deriving the temperature of a black hole. And it's usually the quickest way of finding the temperature of a black hole. But all it is in some way, it's simply a Euclidean way of deriving exactly the same result that you can derive if you go back to the Lorentzian space and then look at a quantum field theory in the background of that classical geometry. You get exactly the same answer. So this is the Hawking temperature of the black hole. As I say, if you just did this first, you wouldn't necessarily trust it, but it's the fact that this was realized after having done the proper calculation. And so it's a cheat's way, so we'll probably get you to do a few computations of temperatures of event horizons. So what you might like to do is to go back to the De Sitter case and look at the temperature associated with the cosmological horizon in De Sitter space and the event horizon, the black hole horizon in De Sitter space, and maybe play around to see, you know, whether you can equilibrate a De Sitter black hole. So I think I'll stop there. And tomorrow we'll look at some more exotic metrics, perhaps with dependence on more than one coordinate, but still keeping the black hole theme.